something else that I thought about. You know, our program has history, and lots of things have history. And, you know, in the statement earlier, it talks about our language, and, you know, there's lots of things that have their own language, you know. And, you know, our fellowship, you know, when someone shares with you, like a fifth step or something, you're supposed to take it to your grave. You know, you got a commitment, and, you know, this thing about if you want out of Narcotics Anonymous, where do you end up? You know, jails, institutions, and death. You know, what does that make you think of? Something like The Sopranos, right? You know? This thing of ours. You know, and sponsorship here. He's with us. I was cracking up when I was thinking about it before. It's like the mafia. And you know what? This fellowship of ours also had a godfather. You know, his name was Jimmy Kinnon. And he was the man who held this thing together for so many years. You know, we know a meeting takes two people to have a meeting. And there are pillars in our fellowship. Jimmy might not have been the only one at that meeting, because how could he have had a meeting? But there are pillars in our fellowship that really hold it together for so many years. You know, the people who put together selfless service. And, you know, I can't tell you about it all because I wasn't there, thank God. But I've been here for 18 years. And I tell you what I know. And I am here to chair the meeting. I'm not here to do it. So I'm going to pass it, you know. But somebody who's going to share has dedicated a lot of her time to this fellowship and understanding and paying attention and talking to people to learn so she could share with us what she's learned. And I'll bring up Fawn.
Hi, everybody. My name's Fawn, and I am an addict. Want to zero in on some peeps out here, just so in case I get nervous. You know, I was thinking about how I got clean in Los Angeles and got turned on to Narcotics Anonymous in Los Angeles, but when I was sitting here looking out at you people, I realized that my home really has been D.C. and the East Coast since 1982, and, you know, I love it out here, and I still, you know, I went to a convention in Los Angeles in January, and I still feel the best thing I ever did was get the hell out of Los Angeles. But, I mean, it's nice to go back and see some, a few old friends, and, but home really is out here, and I'm very fortunate to feel a lot of love in here tonight, and how much history I have with a lot of people in here. You know, even my home group members, I mean, all of a sudden I love you guys, you know. And you know when you, it doesn't matter who you are in NA, your home group, everybody knows you, you know what I mean? They don't give a shit who you are, you know. Oh, she's just, you know, you're just Fawn, you know, or you're just so-and-so, I mean. And it was the same like in L.A., you know, I hear like some of the old-timers mentioned, and I think, God, they really thought he was the shit, you know, I used to see that guy, blah, 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 you know, but I never thought that, you know, I just never thought that one day my experience would be history, you know, and, you know, Jimmy always used to talk about how each and every one of us has our own experience. I mean, we can have sponsors, and you can work the steps the way your sponsor suggests, but you will still have your own experience. And it's the most valuable thing we have is, you know, what we experience in recovery and our understanding of the principles and what the fellowship means to us. So what I'm telling you and sharing with you up here today is what has been passed on to me. So much of our history, a lot of it is written, but a lot of it too has been handed down to us orally. So depending on who you grew up with or who your group is really your experience of history. So what you hear today is my experience, and it's mine, and I don't care what you say. I'm asked to do this workshop a lot out here, and every time I do it, I do a little bit more research or a little bit more digging around in my stuff and just to make it a little bit more interesting. And this year we're very fortunate because we have Terry R. with us from New York City, who's now living in Utah. And he's sharing it with me today. So it's really, you know, and I knew Terry from a long, long time ago. In fact, when I came out here in 82, I remember I went to, it wasn't the very first NA meeting I went to out here, but it was like in the same week. And after the meeting, everybody was talking about, well, what do you want to do? It was like a Friday night. And I said, well, let's go to New York. And they all looked at me like, New York? You know, we were thinking of coffee shops or something. But I just thought, you know, being out here on the East Coast, you know, and Narcotics Anonymous is in New York City, and like, that's where we should be right now. So eventually what I did is a couple weeks later or something, I took a plane up there, and Terry picked me up at the airport, and in this car, I don't think it had a muffler, but it was very loud, and I got in, and you know, we hugged, and as soon as I got in the car, there was a baseball bat right by the gear shift or whatever it was, and I thought, wow, this really is Narcotics Anonymous. And you know, when I got clean, that was pretty much, you know, that's one of the things, like somebody asked me about a month ago, it was Jimmy. He said, do you think when you share, that you could share about like what Jimmy was like or what it was like when you first came around, like what were the meetings like or what was, you know, because usually I come up here and I just read papers and it kind of loses any kind of personal thing that I can throw out there. And people that are close to me have heard me share it on a personal level. But I would like to try and do my best to share a little bit with you more on a personal level what it was like when I got here. And it was pretty much about baseball bats. And it was rugged. let me see. Where in the area I got clean, which was the San Fernando Valley, there was a lot of addicts coming out of the penitentiaries, and lots of tattoos, lots of Chicanos, lots of you know, badasses, and or they thought they were, and you know, just a lot of addicts who wanted to get clean, and. In meetings, I remember, there used to be lots of good fights. I really personally liked the fights as long as there's no weapons. I liked good fist fights. Even to this day, I like a good fist fight. I do. Isn't that weird? they're just kind of fun, you know what I mean? I went to this, when I first came out here, I went to this Genesis concert outdoors or something, and I went to go get a Coke before the concert started, and these two guys were duking it out, and the one guy actually knocked the guy out cold, and I thought that was the neatest thing I'd ever seen, because usually, you know, you never really see someone get knocked out cold, and just a, you know, an amateur sort of, you know, two guys being mad at each other. But anyway, so there used to be a lot of that by old-timers, you know, not just newcomers, you know. you know, it would usually be over a woman or something, and somebody was doing something wrong, and then after they'd wait till after the meeting, or sometimes they'd peek their head in at the break and flip somebody off and point to them like, you're getting it, you know, after the meeting. And then we'd all go out into the alley and wait for the big thing. And and it was exciting. It kept a lot of people coming back. Danny T, who's still around, in fact, he's a big movie star now, he used to wear like this big gold nugget around his neck, and somebody, when one big fight, somebody ripped off the chain, and I remember we were all waiting for them to leave so we could all look around to see who got the nugget lying on the, but nobody, I don't think anybody ever found it. Then another time, oh, the big headliner for the year out in Survivors Club. Survivors Club was this storefront that a bunch of addicts who had some clean time would run meetings, or not run meetings, but they signed the lease to the place. And so meetings would be going on in this place 24 hours, and the seventh tradition that would be collected would be the rent, right? And there used to be mugs, you know, everybody had a little mug and they hang it up there on the wall. And one time, sometimes we'd have like cookie and bake sales to pay for chairs or, you know, and there's always, but every now and then some people would start fixing in the bathrooms and, you know, would take some of these badasses to come in and clean it out. And but it was a great place to hang, because back then, you know, if you weren't in one of the recovery houses, there was nothing to do, you know, all day long. So you'd sit around at this place, hanging out, drinking coffee, or, you know, I think there was a 7-Eleven down the street. And, anyway, this guy Ray, he was messing around too much, and I think his girlfriend caught wind of it, and so she showed up one day and shot him right there. But she didn't kill him. I walked in right here. It was in the shoulder. But that was like the biggest news. That lasted for a long time. So that's kind of like what it was like, you know? And also back then, in the valley, there were two major recovery houses that were started by one of our old-time members, Bill B., who is the fat addict in our little white book. And he, in fact, I went through one. I was court committed, and I was there like 60 days. And then I heard that the one in North Hollywood, you know, people were getting high and fucking over at that one. So I left the one in Pasadena. I went over to that one thinking, you know, that it was happening over there. So I get over there, and there was nothing like that happening. So I ended up getting, you know, I got a probation violation and had to spend the night in jail, and I called up whoever it was, the court rep, and said, hey, get me the hell out of this place. And then I had to just start over, and, you know, at that place. And so a lot of addicts went through those recovery houses. And the reason I mention those recovery houses is because, they, first of all, they were long-term, but that's where a lot of the addicts were coming from, because a lot of them were back then, my recollection was that they were mostly narcotics addicts, and you just couldn't, there really wasn't a place. Like in California, they will bust you just for being high. I know out here, I think it's more like they just, you know, they'll let you just die out there in the street. But in L.A., it was very hard to, you know, be an addict, a practicing addict. So a lot of the, why I bring this up is because the mode of therapy was always the 12 steps. And now they couldn't send us out in vans, you know, like there was about 65 to 80 people. They couldn't send you out in to a small, unsuspecting NA meeting, because we didn't have any seventh tradition, And we were hungry, so we couldn't eat all the donuts and cookies and drink all the coffee and then not put us out of tradition. So they'd send us to the other fellowship, and we'd eat all their donuts, drink all their coffee, not put in the seventh tradition. And then when those members in the other fellowship, in AA, got bent about hearing somebody share about, being a hype or something, oh, we'd jump all over them, We used to love antagonizing the shit out of, AA members. That was our thing, because we were very rebellious. And we loved engaging. Now, mind you, most of us never heard anything about recovery, but when someone was telling us we couldn't be there, oh boy, we just really wanted to just start some, an argument or whatever. Anyway, so a lot of the old timers back then, they were going to both fellowships. In fact, I do remember very vividly hearing, you go to AA to get the message, and you go to NA to give it away. I know that sounds nuts, but back then it made sense, and especially with all the fighting and the, I guess, I don't know. But NA had not really come of age yet. This was, that would have been in 75, 76. Although NA was happening, though, there was a lot of, there were conventions going on. There was the World Service Office that Jimmy was running out of his house starting in 1975. It moved over to Sherman Way, 10717, Sherman Way in Sun Valley. And it was right across the street from an airfield. It was a very modest little house. I think it had like two bedrooms and a bathroom. And for such a... For a house being right across the street from an airfield, it had all these strange flowers that just were blooming everywhere in the front yard. And just everything grew, whether it was a plant or a person. If you hung out around there, you just recovered or grew. And in fact, most of the people that volunteered there were newcomers, mostly from the treatment center. And when I had about, I had 2.5 years clean, mostly in the other fellowship, and I had always had a reservation about drinking and smoking reefer, and so finally I guess I got thirsty, and I went out and drank and smoked reefer, and when I came back, that's when I surrendered to Narcotics Anonymous. And I wanted to wait 30 days to make sure that I'd worked the program before I got involved in a relationship. And so I read all the stuff, and memorized a little bit of it and figured I'd had a good handle on what this program was about. So I had someone scoped out over there. And it was good. He had 5 years. He was nice looking. He had a job. He didn't live with his mother. And he just had a good sense of who he was. His sponsor was Jimmy. And I didn't know who Jimmy was at that time. And he took me over there one day, introduced me to him. And I remembered feeling very comfortable in this man's house. He was married to Betty at the time. And this would have been in 78. And I just felt very at ease. I was very tired. I always like, even to this day, I like being in people's houses where they'll kind of like leave me alone, like your refrigerator's mine. Here's the remote, I don't like to be like constantly having to pay attention. I like to just relax. And so that's what I felt like at his house. Betty and Jimmy used to love garage sales, and they had all kinds of tchotchkes and knickknacks all over the place. And Jimmy was very well-read. He he was like a philosopher. He loved philosophy. He was very knowledgeable. In fact, a lot of going through a lot of his personal writings, I see how what he used to do is he used to like write things that made a definite impression on him, and he would somehow incorporate a lot of the principles behind these things that he would read into our literature, our early literature. Let me remember now. Okay. All right. So, what I remember and what I was told when I was new was that the World Service Office was sort of like the hub or the place where people who wanted to start meetings would contact Jimmy to get starter kits. A starter kit at that time was not even all the IPs we had. Just about how many? Huh?
Seven IPs and a
white book, the little white book. And also a stapled bunches of sheets of paper saying what a treasurer was, what a meeting, how you run a meeting, like a format, meeting format, what a secretary or secretary treasurer, you know, just sort of like an outline to send to groups, right? And so it was like an introduction. The phone, I remember, was always ringing. I still remember the number, 213-765-3821. And you know what? I'll tell you something else. Oh, and I was a secretary, so I was put to work right away. And what was really cool, like a lot of different people who knew Jimmy have different experiences with Jimmy. My experience with him and why we got along was because we would get like really focused in on something, and then we would just do it. And that's the way I've always been. You know, you get a project, and then we just, I would get tunnel vision, like if it was typing out the voice or typing a world directory or typing a return letter, I would just, so it's not that we did a lot of chatting, you know, we just worked. And what I remember about Jimmy is he never sat down. The phone was always ringing, and there were these old file cabinets filled with files, and what these files were divided up like into states, and like if someone would call from like back east or down south or up north or in another country, he would be digging through these files to put that person in contact with another person. You know, he was about networking, you know, like, okay, here's what you're doing, and, you know, blah, 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 and he would just be, and he would spend however long it would take I never heard him say, hey, I gotta go, or hey, I'm talking too long, his phone bill's running out. He never said that. He would talk, because he loved to talk. He would talk as long as he had to make this person feel like they got whatever it is they were calling for. And he had a lot of love. He loved Narcotics Anonymous. I mean, you know, he loved this program. He loved addicts. He was an addict. He had a vision way before most addicts ever had a vision. All that we used to do in Southern California is fight Northern California. That's all we used to do, you know, or fight in our region or areas. Not much different than the way it is now in our areas and regions. You know, just, and you know, I used to wonder about that. You know, I used to think, why are we always fighting, you know? And I think the reason old-timers don't get involved with the areas and the regions much is because, you know, when we're new, we get here, and we're used to being called bitches and bastards and motherfuckers and all that. But when you've been around here for a while and get some self-respect, you won't tolerate it. When you go out here into the world and get a job, as most of you know, nobody talks that way to you. You know, you could sue them now. So in area, because newcomers, we what do we tell newcomers? Get involved. You know, go get a service position. So you get all these new people, you know, coming to area, and they haven't really learned how to, how to talk to one another yet, you know, and you might have an idea. How many times have you seen an old-timer make a suggestion with someone with 90 days saying, what the fuck do you know, you know, or whatever, you know? And I do have noticed that I think we're getting more sophisticated, though, because I have noticed a tremendous change in the way, at least with World Services. I swore when I came out here I would never be involved with World again, ever. And I went to a Unity Day last year, and asked Kieran, right? I said, God, I couldn't believe it. I mean, they had the World Board sitting up here, like, you know, I don't know, it sort of looked like the band of angels, and then you had all these addicts from different parts of the country and world out there with laptops, you know, and they would get up and nobody cursed, you know. I mean, I remember a time at World Services when you had trustees screaming fuck you so loud that the veins in their neck were bulging out. I mean, it was very verbal. So, because we were really growing, you know, there was so much going on. I mean, damn, you know, just a lot of growing. So anyway, working in this office, I do want to share a couple of little things stories that you'd appreciate. I remember one day a letter came in, I think it was from Alaska, and this letter came in, and what Jimmy had sent this guy, and this loner, a starter kit, and so the guy wrote back this letter, and every now and then when a winter letter would come in, Jimmy would turn us on to it, you know, and what this guy had done is he had written this letter in time increments, right, like he would say, 8 o'clock, I think the meeting started at 8:30, he goes, it's 8 o'clock, the doors are open, I turned on the hot water, okay, to make the coffee, okay, then at 8:15, I set up the chairs, and then 8:30. Oh, and the literature was out. I'm not remembering it exactly, but you get my drift, okay? And then 8:30, the meeting is open. There's nobody here, but the meeting is open. Then at 8:45, no one's here yet, but everything is in place. Well, this went on in 15-minute increments till around 10 o'clock, till it was over, and nobody ever showed up. And he said, well, nobody came. He goes, but I'm going to be here next week. You know, and I just thought about, you know. So that's the kind of belief, you know, some of us members had back then, you know, just that little bit of hope that, you know, that we could stay clean with this thing called Narcotics Anonymous. Then there is something else. Oh, I gotta read you this. A couple years ago, when I was given a history, the guy from England sent me. He said, "Could you read this? Could you read this to them?" Because he was remembering what it was like when it was brand new over there. And this is what it says. Message from member in UK. I cannot tell you how nice it was to revisit those early days again in my mind whilst writing the UK history. The enthusiasm, the togetherness and purpose, and how members traveled over from Ireland to those early fellowship gatherings. What always brings a smile to my face is just how big that first group grew. We were afraid to split into another group. I guess we feared losing the strength we found together. Unfortunately, faith in a higher power was a bit in short supply in our early days. Picture this, a large basement room with two windows that open to ground level outside and two that don't. A room so full of recovering addicts that they stood on tables at the sides, against the wall at the back of the room, and sat sideways across the windowsills of the two windows that didn't open. Behind the table and the speaker, etc., are open windows at either side. With six addicts laying on their bellies in the courtyard outside, with their heads poking through these two open windows to get into the meeting. through the doorway, left down the 18-foot-long passage, and left again up a good 15 stairs, was solid with addicts seeking recovery. This is not an exaggerated tale of an old man. This is exactly how it was. With a lot of people, what a lot of people don't know is this, that earlier on, we ended up as just three members. Dudley said, "Nobody's coming in from Johnny's PI efforts. Let's wind this thing up." I replied, "Over my dead body, if nobody else ever walks in through that door, I still need to stay clean." We have NA today with the faces we have today because we continue to help each other to stay clean. I thank God with tears in my eyes for this. When we examine our roots and the reason we are still alive today, we familiarize ourselves again with what we as a fellowship set out to do in the first place. And so I thought that was really cool too, from England. And so anyway, what you had is this, you had Jimmy, who was, you know, I do have to say, I do want to tell you something else. A lot of times I knew that Jimmy knew everything, okay? I knew he was enlightened, okay? I can't think of a better word to say it, but that's what he was. And sometimes when we had a break or something, I would say, we'd be sitting there and I'd go, okay, tell me about the eighth tradition. And he'd start off, right, and about 5 minutes into it, I'd go, oh, okay, never mind. Because, you know, it would go right over my head, you know. I was a newcomer. I didn't know what all that meant. You know, all I knew was that service was keeping me clean. It was a power greater than myself. And it gave me a sense of purpose. And it started to make me love this fellowship and this program. And through reading the letters, through answering some of them, through the funnest nights were when the volunteers, we'd meet up on Tuesdays and Thursday nights, and we'd sit on his living room floor, and we'd be folding the IPs, you know, creasing them, because the printer would, you know, have them on a flat sheet of paper, and then we'd fold them, and then with the little white books, we'd be stapling them. And we'd sit around and share stories, or like, hey, I went to a really good meeting the other night, and just like we do today when we go to coffee, or when we, you know, sit around before the meeting, when you get there earlier, when you stay after, the same kind of conversations. And so a lot hasn't changed over the years, you know. There's still that feeling of identification, of tremendous love that happens in a room when there's more than two of us gathered together. And I was taught when I got here, I do remember a few things Jimmy said. One of them was, if you give Narcotics Anonymous a chance, you'll never have to be alone again, you'll never have to run again, and you'll learn how to stand up on your own two feet and think for yourself. And that's always been enough for me. If I would have never read any more promises than that, that would have been, that still continues to be, I mean, just think. I mean, for an addict like me to be told that there'd come a time with just a little bit of effort and willingness and honesty that I could really learn how to pick for myself. So that's what I remember. I remember he answered the phone. He was always on his feet. And you have to remember, too, that all of us had full-time day jobs. So when we'd go over there after dinner, when we would be starting our service shift, he was still going from early on in the day. And I was always very amazed at his level of dedication. Even, I mean, I don't know about you, but for me, there have been many times in many service commitments that I've made where I've said, "Oh, screw that, man! I'm not going. I'm going to stay home. I want to watch TV. I want to watch The Sopranos. I want to, you know, be with my old man. I want to go shopping. I want to go see what's happening at Nordstrom's. Whatever, right? I don't want to go there tonight, you know. But not him. I mean, it was amazing, you know, and." He had a very, one of the things that, he never used to say anything about the personal contributions that he made. The very first time I did a workshop, I asked, I called Betty up, this was after Jimmy died, and I called Betty up and I said, "Hey Betty, you know, who wrote what in the little white book? You know, like, can you tell me who wrote what, just to give him something?" Because this is back in, this is about, you know, 1990, when I thought I had to give you all, like, you know, factual data, you know. And so, this is what she told me. In 1960, Jimmy wrote, "Who is an Addict?" In 1960, "What is the NA Program?" was written by Jimmy Kennan and another member, Sylvia Wexler. In 1960, Jimmy Kennan and Sylvia Wexler wrote, "Why Are We Here?" The paragraphs before and after the steps and how it works was written by Jimmy in 1960. In 1960, Jimmy Kennan wrote Recovery and Relapse. In 1960, Jimmy Kennan wrote What Can I Do? In 1961, Jimmy Kennan wrote We Do Recover. In 1962, Phil Phillips wrote One Third of My Life. In 1962, Penny Kennedy wrote I Can't Do Any More Time. Around 1962, Gene H. wrote The Vicious Cycle. In 1962, Bob B. wrote Something Meaningful. In 1963, Jimmy wrote, I thought it was 1967, Another Look. In 1975, more stories were added to the Little White Book. In 76, Greg Pierce wrote I Was Different. In 76, Betty Kay wrote Fearful Mother. And in 76, Bill B. wrote Fat Addict. And when she told me all that, I had no idea that he wrote that much stuff. And the reason I didn't know is because he never said it. He never, so although he was humble in that way, I don't want you to think he was a pussy, because he was had a very strong sense of who he was. He never balked on the traditions. If anybody tried to pull some shit in our fellowship, he was right there. He never was intimidated by a group, by a person, by an entire, hey, in 1981, he retired from the entire Board of Trustees because he did not agree with what they were doing. And that's the kind of man he stood on principle. He was my hero. If anybody that knows me knows that, and I don't like people that say anything bad about him. And you know what? If you don't like that, tough shit. So I take it very personal when people say anything derogatory about him, because I knew him, and the way that my experience of him was that he was not a man who was vindictive. He was not a man who was mean-hearted. He was not a man who would ever do anything to hurt you. And if you were an addict, he would pull you up. He would pull you up if you were doing something like trying to carry the message into the prison system and charge money for it. We had that happen. He would pull you up if you were violating our traditions. And because of that, a lot of personal vendettas that's my whole read on what happened, especially in California. Having lived out here and having lived out there, I have never seen or experienced the West Coast versus East Coast mentality. Never. I looked for it, but I never felt it. I felt the Northern and Southern California thing, but I never felt that. So if you hear that, I was looking for it and didn't feel it. I love the way Narcotics Anonymous, the fresh approach that it has out here on the East Coast. I've always loved that. My experience of the addicts in Narcotics Anonymous on the East Coast has been one of tremendous pride in our fellowship. We do not take this thing for granted. I feel so, I never have to argue about, you know, our fellowship being the butter. I mean, to me, this is it, you know, and it's not even an issue anymore. If you hear it, just look at somebody like as if they're like out in, what century are you from? Because it's almost a mood issue, you know, to be talking about any, you know, to be talking about that argument anyway. You could just say, hey, get with the program. some things, we have come of age. We have come of age, in case you didn't know. we're all over the world. You know, Terry's going to share with you more about Narcotics Anonymous on the East Coast and about the basic text. I really just wanted to give you a little bit of a sense of Jimmy Kennan, even until the day... Oh, I know. One last thing. I have to read it, though, because it's heavy. Terry, what, did you steal it? Oh, here it is, sorry. Jimmy made a promise a long time ago when he was hospitalized in 1968 for TB, which affected his throat to the extent that doctors told him he would not be able to speak again. During his stay there, he vowed that if he regained his voice, that as long as he lived, this is what he told God, his higher power, that if he regained his voice, that as long as he lived, he would use what voice and what strength he had to further the efforts of Narcotics Anonymous. And he kept that promise. He expressed his feelings best when he said, "You and I have been given, through illness, through suffering, and through disease, a talent for helping other human beings like ourselves. Let's never forget that we have it and that we are responsible for others, but primarily we are responsible for ourselves." He always used to say our program is a program for life and living. It was also during this stay in the hospital that he carved out a symbol for NA on a piece of leather. And, you know, I was looking through some old writings, and he wrote so many letters during this time because he couldn't talk. So he was writing letters to his son in Vietnam. Now check this out, because I never knew this, but I found this letter. I never read it before because I thought, oh, it's just a letter to his son. But it's this long-ass letter. His son was some hotshot in the military over in Vietnam, and they were trying to figure out, because they figured out that our addiction is a disease, they used to think, they didn't know what to do with all the addicts in Vietnam. So Jimmy was trying to lay out for them what to do, you know? And he was trying to say, look, here's the contact number. You call these couple of judges, because Jimmy was a real PR guy, too. He really, you know, like, he and his crew would go to the police stations and, you know, and do this surveillance thing. That was very important in the beginning, because addicts were scared shitless to go to meetings because they were afraid of getting popped, you know? Because a lot of people were, you know, had outstanding warrants or whatever they should, you know. So he set that whole thing up, you know, and they had, he had a promise from them that our meetings would not be staked out. So that was a real biggie. And then he had a rapport with the prison systems in that area, you know, and he was just an H&I man to the core, you know. There's all kinds of writing about that. And in the little bit of history that I have, I don't really believe that we really got going until 1960. Because in the 50s, when we got started, actually the idea was born in 52. Him and Doris, this woman Doris, had talked around, you know, and then in 53, you know, about the board and all that. But see, AA's traditions hadn't come out till 1950. So it was taking a little while for this whole tradition idea to come up. And Jimmy had gotten clean in AA in 1950. So by 1953, he had a sense of what the traditions were by then. Lots of AA meetings in the country weren't even, you know, incorporating them into their meetings yet. But he saw, his experience was that when the groups became about a personality, or like a main guy, that those meetings always folded. And our NA folded in 1959 because of that. You know, addicts couldn't stand up to certain very strong personalities. The hot seat, you know, the hot seat thing that was being used. A lot of that shit, you know. And Jimmy wouldn't go to those meetings. I mean, he'd go once in a while, but he knew it was doomed. So in 1960, he and I think it was Penny, they started over, and that's why he wrote all that literature, you know. Handwriting, that's his handwriting, you know. I know his handwriting, and that's his handwriting. And most of the areas where you see him, his signature, it's always last. You know, he just was not about wanting. He did it for the protection of our fellowship, you know. It could have been real easy for him to say, hey, I did this and I did that. You know, no, that's for people like me to do. But, oh, he would kill me if he was alive right now. But you know, I just can't say enough that I just feel so excited about being a member of this fellowship. I have the greatest friends. Where's Karen? Okay, you better not leave. I live in a really cool area. You know, people that know me know I'm always wanting to move, you know? And my children have been like the anchor in my recovery, you know, because I can't go anywhere, you know? I have to stay put, you know? And it's been good because this has been like a home for me, and it's my home. Anyway, I've shared enough. I'm sorry if I talk too long. Terry brought a lot of his stuff out here. We have a bunch of archives out here for you guys to share. Please don't lift anything, though, because most of this stuff is originals. And, you know, we've been entrusted with schlepping it around, keeping it safe, and sharing it with others. Is there anything else? If I forgot something, hey, keep coming back. And thanks so much for letting me share.
Thanks very much, Fawn. Before I leave, Fawn, you got to give me the address of that North Hollywood group. Make it my home group. I don't have all history with Fawn, but I do with Terry. It was one of the first meetings I walked into in New York. I was a young kid, 22 years old, and I went to the meeting, and I was told when I got out of the place I was at to go to a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. And I went to the meeting, and he was downstairs there with another guy named Kevin F. from New York. And they asked me, what did I want? And I told them that I was told to come here, and Narcotics Anonymous is a place where I should be. And I was 22, living at home, which my mother is very nice, and still live at home. It's my home. And I was dressed nice and clean because my parents, they groomed me, you know, kept me alive, you know, kept me going. And he asked me, what did I want? I says, well, I'm here. I'm told to come here. And I said, well, what'd you do, kid? And I told him I freebase cocaine. And he told me cocaine wasn't addicting. You know? I might have been the first crackhead in New York City to walk into a meeting. You know? And I never felt as though I didn't belong because I didn't put a needle in my arm. Because then he says, all right, this is where you belong. This is where they told you to come, sit down, and listen. You know, and I know the history of Narcotics Anonymous in New York, and I know that Terry was one of the members that started the first group. And, you know, Fawn said to come up here and look at this stuff later, and they were speaking earlier. They said, we need newcomers to watch the stuff because the more experienced members will steal the shit, you know? So we got some newcomers. They'll be watching you later. All right, with that, I want to bring up Terry. Okay, I'll tell you a story about the letter. All right. Terry was one of the early members of Narcotics Anonymous. what we call as one of the founders, and they didn't have no literature, and they wanted literature, and they kept sending letters to the World Service Office. Terry says it. Fawn says she was there, and there were no letters coming in, so we're not sure if they had the right address. But one day, Terry wrote a letter, and he wrote in the letter, he says, you know, it'd be easier for me to get 2 ounces of pure heroin from my connection than it is to get some literature from you assholes. Terry still says those words. But as I hear the story, Fawn says that that day they received that letter, Jimmy jumped up on a table, and he was dancing because they wanted Narcotics Anonymous in New York. You know? The people were going to get clean there. And I want to bring up Terry that I'm going to share with you.
My name's Terry, I'm an addict. And, at the time, I think I was calling the office, and whoever I was getting, they were sending me 7 IPs and a white book. And we had like 4 or 5 meetings going. So I sat down with this girl, and I dictated the letter, and she wrote it. And it says, it would be easier for me to get an ounce of pure heroin from my old connection than it would be to get literature from you fucking people. Fuck you if you can't take a joke. I'll meet you at the 11th World Convention, and if you don't like it, we'll talk about it in the parking lot. And that's, you know, most of the founding fathers of, like, on the East, most of them are out of their minds. We were nuts, man. It was just, the thing, you got to understand the love and the spirit. A lot of you are spoiled. You come into a meeting, everything's here. The literature's there, the coffee's there. We came around, we didn't have shit. We didn't have a pot to piss in. We didn't have a window to throw. We had nothing. We had to go scrape it up. You know, and it wasn't easy getting meetings, you know, for Narcotics Anonymous. I remember in New York, one of the first, third meeting we had in New York City, there was this AA meeting who was dying. So this guy turned it over to us. It was in Cabrini Hospital. We had the meeting in there like for 3 months, and then this other fellowship came in and wanted a meeting there too. And they said, well, you have Narcotics Anonymous in here. And they didn't even know we had the meeting going. They threw us the fuck out. And we had to bring the meeting to a park. So we had that meeting for 2 months in 14th Street Park. They were dealing down here, dealing down there. And we were sitting on the benches having a meeting. And that's the way it was. And Jimmy was a big part of whatever was happening all across the United States. Like Fawn said, he's like, you'd call him up, and if you wanted to know somebody or you needed a contact, he had it. And like after we started the meetings in New York, I'd get a phone call, Terry, you got to go up to 113th Street in Harlem, enter East Harlem. They want to start a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. You know, I didn't ask any questions. I just got in my car and we went up there and started it. And that's the way it was, man. And we started meetings until they were starting to go. And then we go start another one. And we had like a meeting in the Bronx. We had Lino and Popo. Lino had 30 days and Popo had 60 days. Lino chaired it and, you know, Popo took care of whatever else. And that's the way it was. You know, and then we had 90 days to do service. And you know, me and Fawn were talking, you know, there's a lot of shit in politics in any organization, and it's gone down. And we didn't want to get into that. We wanted to share the love of how this fellowship came about. And Jimmy was the fucking, he was the glue. He was the glue that held everything together. And there's been times where people tried to knock him out of the box. You know, they talk about HFD, habit forming drugs, not a part of our fellowship, not a part of our history. Danny Carlson in New York City, same name, not our fellowship, not a part of our organization. They have 2 letters in the archives where Jimmy wrote to Danny Carlson, telling him about what's going on, and Danny Carlson wrote back he wanted no part of us. You know, so Jimmy is the founder of this fellowship as far as I'm concerned. And I'm like, Fawn, you know, if you're going to say something bad, you know, I take personal offense, because I love that man. He helped save my life, you know, because I would call Jimmy up, man, and he's like, "What?" You know, I'd be fucking nuts, you know. And I was like chief cook and bottle washer at a lot of meetings, and I'd ask Jimmy, and he'd say, "Do this, do that," and I just follow his direction, you know, and he was cool, you know, and like John says, the mafia, you know, I was buying stolen phone cards on the streets of New York calling up Jimmy. And I tell Jimmy, "Hey, Jimmy, if the phone company calls, you don't know who called you, okay?" And I wish I would have went to any length to get Narcotics Anonymous going. And that letter I wrote Jimmy, 2 weeks later, I'm at home and I get a phone call. Terry Ryan, I don't know, nobody uses my whole name. I says, "Yeah." He says, "You don't know me. My name is Jimmy Kennan. I'm the manager of the World Service Office." And he said, "Since we got your letter, we know Narcotics Anonymous is going to grow and flourish in New York City. We've just sent you $500 worth of literature. Pay us when you can." And that's the way it was back then. And even before we had that $500 paid off, they sent us another $500. You know? And we were willful and crazy. And even before they sent that literature, I took those 7 IPs to a printer. And I had literature printed up just as good, maybe even better than theirs. You know, because we were like, you know, like the Blues Brothers, we were on a mission from God. You know? And it wasn't about, you know, anybody being the president of Narcotics Anonymous or, you know, how the big shots are today. You know, like Jimmy never took any kind of recognition in what he did, and he did a lot. You know, you could call up Jimmy and say, "I'm going somewhere," and like he'd dig through those files and he'd pull out a name and he'd give you a phone number, and he would talk. I would talk to him, and sometimes I'd have to, "Jimmy, shut the fuck up." You know. And when I would call him up, he knew it was me. He'd answer the phone. I'd say, "How are you, old fuck you?" And he'd say, "What do you say? What do you do, Terry?" You know. And I had a deep love for that man, for the commitment he had for this fellowship and the love. And like I said, he was the glue, man. He was the glue, man, no matter what. And one of the best things he told me, you know, I was at a service meeting and nuts, and I called him up. And he says, "Hey, Terry, just sit back and watch the cartoons." I've been clean 22 years, and I go to conventions, and I sit outside in meetings, and I watch the cartoons. They're better than Looney Tunes. Disney or any of them. But that was the love we had, the commitment and the dedication. And the way the message spread across the East Coast, we had the East Coast Convention. And I remember I was with this Henry. Henry started the first meeting up in the Bronx. And I got a call from some guy and said, they're having the East Coast Convention in Pennsylvania. I said, "Come on, Henry, you gotta go." Henry says, "What are we gonna do there? What do we, you know?" I says, "Listen, we're gonna go to Pennsylvania," or was it Jersey? I said, "We're gonna go up there and we're gonna meet dope fiends that sit on milk cans and tie up with cow's tails and get off." You know, Henry said, "Yeah, okay, let's." So we went. And it was the first convention I've ever seen. There was 308 clean addicts there. You know, that was the most amount of addicts I've ever seen in my life, clean. And the way the history of the East Coast Convention, you would put in a bid. You would come in and put in a bid, and we'd get in a room, and Chris remembers, remember Washington? And everybody put in their bid, and most of the times it always went to the place that needed it the most. It was like doing a 12-step call on that state. And wherever that went, and we had the East Coast Convention, right after we left, Narcotics Anonymous bloomed. It flourished. You know? And we go here, and we supported each other. You know, you guys talk about oh, I got to go to that regional meeting. When we started off, we belonged to the Mid-Atlantic region. It went from Maine to Virginia. And the regional meeting was anywhere in between, and sometimes you'd have to drive 8, 10, 12 hours to get to it. You know, and that was a commitment. And we went, and we supported each other. And there was a lot of psychos, you know. You know, and but it was the commitment. And the foundation, this fellowship has been on commitment. The commitment Jimmy had to carry the message from one addict to another. And that commitment of other addicts to heard the message, to carry that message to another addict and another addict. You know, and that's what made this fellowship grow across the United States. And another thing that helped grow across the United States when it got out of California was the World Convention. And it was the same way. It wasn't like now the World Service Conference and Office takes care of it and they tell us where it's going to be, but back in the beginning, same thing. You put in the bid, you got the hotels together, and you know, you did this, you did that, and you met in a room, and every state or region would put it in their pitch to get it in their town. You had to have the right, you know, and wherever the World Convention was, the fellowship flourished and grew. You know, when we had it in New York, I put in the bid when it was the Levitt World Convention, there was two meetings in New York. Yeah. When we finally put in the bid in Milwaukee, we had 10 meetings. We stole letterheads from the mayor's office in New York City, and we had it all typed up nice and proper. And I forced the mayor's signature, and we handed that. You know, we would go to any lengths to get Narcotics Anonymous going, hey, man, you know, it was like... And we had a home, and at that one East Coast convention, we got up there, and we put in the presentation, and I got up, and I started talking about, you know, the addicts in New York City don't know about a loving God, you know, and recovery, you know, from active addiction. And, you know, they're dying. Everybody that had put a bid in withdrew, except Southern California. You know? We won hands down, and it was cool. And we had the 13th World Convention, and Jimmy came and he spoke there. It was the first time he ever came out of California to speak at a convention. And I was on the phone with Jimmy every week. Jimmy, you coming? I don't know. I was hustling, man. I was working. And then finally one day he says, yeah, I'll come. And it was like, I was so, you know, it was like the greatest thing in the world. And before then, I'd been to California. You know, I was talking to this guy on the phone, and I envisioned Jimmy as like, somebody about the size of John Wayne and that kind of stature, you know. And when I seen him, he was this little skinny guy, and I'm like, fuck, you know. And I blew my head, but like he had all that love and all this information. I met this guy, Doug Fortsmith, out there, and we became friends, and we've been like friends for a long time. And it's been a great, great journey. Now, I live in Utah now, and I'm still in service. You know, when I moved to Utah, I started a little meeting in my living room, started with 4 people. Now we got 21 people coming a week, and that's the way it is. You know, if you're new, you know, you want to start a meeting, get a goddamn coffee pot and some literature and go start. And don't listen to any old times and say, well, you got to have time to start a meeting. You can 90 days, go start a meeting, man. And if you got a resentment, go start a meeting. You know? That's how a lot of the meetings started, and that's how a lot of areas started, you know. And when we had that, we finally got the 13th World Convention and our first fundraiser. Went out and got 150 chickens, all these vegetables where they're cooking and everything. We got all this chicken, all these string beans. We got food up the yin yang, and we're sitting there. And it's like, it's supposed to start at 8 o'clock, and nobody's there, it's just us. And I'm like, oh, God. everything's going to fall apart. And then the spirit of Narcotics Anonymous came through. That fucking door kicked open. There was a caravan of cars from Philadelphia, Lancaster, Pennsylvania, Connecticut. They all busted in at the same time. We had a great fundraiser. And we pulled together. And back then, we supported each other. You know, we would go the distance, man. We had guys from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, driving 10 hours, 8 hours, whatever the hell it was, to come down and support our one little meeting in Queens. You know, and it was like that. You know, and what fucks up Narcotics Anonymous is the politics and the politicians. If we could leave that out, we'd be fine. If we could just hug each other, spend time with each other, and like Fawn says, you know, have a safe haven. And it's like I was in Jimmy's house, man. As soon as I got there, he had a pot of soup on the stove. You want some soup? Here, sit down, kid, make yourself comfortable. You know, a lot of times, you know, in the beginning, on the East Coast, we used to put people up on like our couches. I had many people kicking my couch. You know, you don't see that today. You don't see people going out of their way to help a newcomer. You know, I love these big shots in Narcotics Anonymous. They'll fly 4,000 miles to speak at a convention. But they won't walk across the street to talk to a newcomer. And the spirit is one addict helping another, no matter who he is. You know, I got some time. Sometimes I'm crazy. You know, but it's that spirit and that love. That's what Jimmy instilled in us. You know, and he was a man of integrity. When a lot of this political stuff went down, he could have stopped it all. He had the control and the power. But he just said, whatever's best for the fellowship, whatever the fellowship wants, you know? And he did it. There was a lot of hurt there, a lot of pain. And that comes along with being in service, a lot of hurt and pain. And it's a growing pains of the fellowship, you know? And it's just, stuff like this came out, you know? This is the manuscript of our basic text. This is what went out all over the country for approval, for your input if you're around. And this book wasn't written by any one group of people. This was written by the fellowship. You know? This was written by professional addicts. And we had literature conferences all over the country. And you want to see a bunch of ragtag motherfuckers? I swear to God, you know, they weren't no saints. They didn't walk on water. They were screw-ups, you know? And then this is what was sent out also, our personal stories. Some were taken, some weren't. You know, it was all done by group conscience. And this piece came out, this was sent to all the RSRs in the different regions. Then the first one that came out was the Red Book. This one was signed by Jimmy Cannon, Betty Cannon, and most of the founders, old-timers, and Narcotics Anonymous. I still have the order form. It was $35. And you had to have some faith back then. Because we sent the $35, and we waited a long time. You know, first we thought we were getting beat. But then this book came. You know, this was our book. And after this book came about, a lot more people started to recover because they could sit down and have something to read. And with the $35 they made on each book, they had enough money to print the first edition, the blue book. This was the special edition, and this was the blue book. And a lot of work went into this, and a lot of love. You know, and there was a lot of misguided people, and a lot of fanatics. We are fanatics. If you remember Narcotics Anonymous, you're a black sheep and you're some kind of fanatic. And a lot of things were done, but a lot of it was done, maybe a lot of it was misguided, but it was all done. They wanted something. They wanted a place for us to recover, to have a home, so we didn't have to go to that other place. I got clean in that other fellowship, you know? It was just like, I felt like I was a leper, you know, a moral leper. You know, oh, you're one of those. Man, my whole life I was one of those. You know, stick me in a methadone program, lock his ass up in jail, send him to Kentucky. You know, and when I came here, I was one of us. You know. And it was the fellowship where I could say fucking God in the same sentence, nobody got it. You know, and I could tell you how I felt. Like, you know, I go into meetings and tell I hate all of you. I wish you'd all use. You know, they'd say, well, keep coming back. You know, and this is the way we are. This is the fellowship of every black sheep, and every family in the United States probably belongs to our fellowship. You know, and there's a lot of other stuff here. All the IPs we have. That piece there is from the starter kit. I kept writing and getting. They sent me 7 pieces of literature and a goddamn white book. But from that letter, it grew a beautiful, loving relationship with a man I will never forget until the day I die. He taught me something. You know, I'll never be able to do enough for Narcotics Anonymous. Because what it's done to me is made a bum. A useless addict that lived in boiler rooms and rooftops, learning how to get some self-esteem, how to learn to walk down the street, not look at the cracks in the sidewalk while I'm going to the connection. You know, it helped me. I can look in your eyes with love, and I can care, and I can share the NA way. You know, it's a beautiful tradition we have. And let's not ever lose that. You know, Jimmy worked time. I remember when Jimmy was dying. I got a phone call, and I was talking to Jimmy, and he says, you know, he had lung cancer at the time, and they were going in to scrape his lungs. And he called me up, and, you know, he was saying his goodbyes. And he was telling me, Terry, I wish we had more time to spend together, and, you know, and we talked, and it was just like, I got off the phone, I was like fucked up, man. You know, I was crying. My old lady never seen me cry before, because, you know, I was one of those tough guys, you know, out of the penitentiary, and you know, I was crying like a baby. And I walked around for about 6 hours, and I just said, fuck this. I took one of those stolen credit cards. I called up Jimmy. I said, listen, you old fuck. I said, you ain't dying. I said, I got a plane ticket to come and visit you in 30 days, so. You know, and Jimmy said, well, I'm sorry, you know. And I said, Jimmy, you're human. You know, and he went through a lot of pain with a lot of things, and he didn't let a lot of people see or feel that pain, you know. And I was fortunate to talk to him, and, you know, I was out of my mind. You know, a few times I told him, hey, Jimmy, you know, I'll get on a plane, we'll come there, we'll get some 45s, and I'll blow their brains out. And he'd say, Terry, we can't do that today. Okay, Jimmy. Because he was my hero. You know, he taught me how to show up, suit up, show up, and stay there. You know, he instilled in me a love and a grace that, you know, I'll never know from any other human being. You know, and here are some pictures of when he spoke at the 13th World Convention. There's pictures here of Jimmy in front of the office, which was his house. This building here was the first meeting, Cantera and Clybourne. You know, that man kept these doors open for us when they started to close down. And when, like Fawn said, when a lot of the tradition violations started to come up, and people like selling the message of Narcotics Anonymous and trying to incorporate it with treatment centers. He said no. And like a lot of the things that Jimmy did and put a stop to, people had vendettas, you know, and shit happens, man. And it's just the way it is. But look at the fellowship we have today. We're growing. But the thing is, it's like Jimmy had this dream that we'd have Narcotics Anonymous all over the world. And it's come true. You know, and in the early days in New York, we had members that left Mona. She left New York City with 9 months clean, went to Israel, started the first meeting of Narcotics Anonymous in Israel. She's not with us. She ended up dying of an overdose. She couldn't get it, but she was the one who passed the message. And when I saw a girl today, and she says, I'm from Israel. I said, oh yeah. I said, did you know Mona? She said, yeah, Mona helped me stay clean. You know, but Mona couldn't make it. You know, and then there was Johnny Horton from England. He was just as much of a lunatic as I was. And the World Service Office hated him as much as they hated me. You know? I always start shit at a fucking drop of a hat, you know? And it's just, Jimmy taught me, stick up for your rights and fight what you think is right. And there was a girl, Olivia. She was from Dublin, Ireland. I'm home one night again, and the phone rings, and this Irish broke. Hi, hello, I'm Olivia, I'm from NA in Ireland. And I was about right to say, yeah. Who is this really? Yeah, so I bit my tongue and she said, well, I'm in Manhattan. And I says, where are you? She was in this bagel mosh. She says, I'll be right there. I just got dressed, jumped in my van, and I met her. And I met so many neat people that carried this message. You know, of hope and light. And that's what the history of Narcotics Anonymous is, love. And you can see in this case over here, we have almost every original white book. We have world directories. In 1976, there was Narcotics Anonymous in Maryland. We have one number and address in here. You know, we had meetings in Australia, Canada, Montana, and it was starting to grow. You know, and it's just, yeah, it's beautiful. And we do have some ugly history, but let's not think about that. Let's think about the future. You know, the newcomer that's still out there, still needs help, comes into the room stinking like shit. You ever see those people when you're in a meeting? Newcomer, oh my God, he smells. Even though they smell, you pull them in, you take them out, give them a meal, give them some coffee, you know, and you give them a love. Because I was a lunatic when I got here, man. People pulled me in, you know. They loved me until I could love myself. And I read the literature, and I called up Jimmy all the time. You know, and there's other history, you know, stuff that went on, and, you know, the changing of the white book. You know, there's some devious stuff in there, but it's all behind us. All that stuff is behind us. What we got to do is for the future. And like Fawn was saying, the new service that's coming out, you know, I go to regional meetings now, it's like, it's not the same. You know, they're going into consensus form in my region, and it's real neat. You know, it's like where the dope fiends can't dope fiend anymore. You know, everybody tries to agree agreeably and, you know, with love. And and live. For Maryland, I just want to pull this out. I'll probably break this guy's anonymity, but fuck him if he can. I've always been so spiritual. My old lady laughs at me. You know, I can't find it, right? Can you find it? Huh? That's his name?
No, Aberdeen.
Aberdeen, well.
You're the secretary, goddammit. You know, and another thing is like when Jimmy came to the World Convention and like he wanted to see Ellis Island. See, because Jimmy came across a boat to Ellis Island. And on one of his tapes he talks about a white Russian that he befriended on Ellis Island. And of course the guy could speak English. And Jimmy got to come into the country and this white Russian was sent back to Russia and put to death most likely. You know, and he wanted to go back to his roots. And another thing a lot of people don't know, Jimmy lived in Kensington, Philadelphia. And at one point, Jimmy was going to become a priest. But he became an addict. Yeah. And he was a boxer. He used to box down in Kensington. You know, and he was this little wiry guy, and he was a roofer. He was just no special, he wasn't an executive or anything, he was just a spiritual man. You know, and he believed in a spiritual journey. And he believed in Narcotics Anonymous, not to get clean time, but to change. To have a spiritual life. You know, and to come here and share your strength, hope, and spirit. And not to come here and become a fucking screamer. And hold these fucking books up and pound and fucking hoop and holler. You know, bullshit. That's just my personal opinion. We're here to carry a message of love so the newcomer can hear it, the old timer can hear it, and we're all welcome here. We're all equal here, whether you've got 10 days, 20 years, 30 years. You know, and I like to leave this for the newcomers. You know, just if you ever want to use, pick up the phone. I don't care if it's 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning, call somebody. And if somebody says, you know what time it is, tell them to go fuck themselves. And call somebody else that cares. Give that motherfucker no resentment. Let them go share to his sponsor, his home group, have some newcomer call, woke him up at 5 in the morning because he wanted to save his goddamn life and you turn him down. You know? Because newcomer, like Jimmy said, was the life of the stunt, you know, program. And I'm just starting to ramble. I'd like you to enjoy seeing these, the literature and the white books and a lot of things. We have some of Jimmy's original writings on another look. And you know something? If it wasn't for Jimmy, we wouldn't have Narcotics Anonymous. We wouldn't have World Service conferences. We wouldn't have a World Service office. We wouldn't have any of this stuff. And last thing I want to leave you with, remember, you owe your life to Narcotics Anonymous. So when you're driving that Lexus into the parking lot that says I-O-N-A on the back of it, and you come into the room with a triple butterscotch latte, it costs $6.65, and that basket comes by, you better put some money in that. If you see a lot of them, you'll just like float past them like a ghost under a day, or a troll quarter in. Or a dollar. What can a dollar buy? Can't even buy a pack of cigarettes. Gallon of gasoline. And you know, if you're going out on a date to go get laid, man, you're going to put up at least $100, show, movie. You know, what's your life worth, man? Put some money in the basket. We need it. The newcomers need literature. You know? Oh, shut up. Thank you.
Okay, we have this room till 3:30, so what we're going to do is we'll get together, we'll form a circle, meet just for today, and then we'll take the rest of the time to kind of look at the stuff if you want, or, you know, talk and stuff like that. All right? So let's make a circle. Thank you.
Yeah.